Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Ian Noble, founder of Run Steady Investments and a true example of what happens when entrepreneurial grit meets long-term vision. Ian spent 14 years building and running a 14-location dry cleaning business in Austin, Texas, a company his father founded back in the 1980s. After buying it from him in 2016, Ian led a complete turnaround, scaling operations to more than 90 employees before successfully exiting in 2023. Now, Ian helps other business owners do what he's done, transition from active ownership to passive income through real estate. With investments spanning mobile home parks, lending funds, and syndications, he's proving that financial freedom doesn't have to come at the cost of burnout. Ian, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Ed, thank you for having me.
Great to have you today. So let's start at the beginning. I definitely want to dive into the family business aspect. What do you remember most as a younger version of you growing up around your dad's dry cleaning business in Austin?
He started taking me around to the cleaning facilities, and that's where you actually are cleaning the laundry and pressing the clothes when I was really young. So I always remember it was fun, I guess, as a kid going there. I wasn't working in the business when I was real young. They had these laundry carts that I used to, when he would spend a lot of time there. And this is dating back to me being very young. They'd throw some blankets down in these laundry carts, and that became my nap space. But as the time went on, I just remember my dad having a lot of free time. There's obviously pros and cons to that. He had chosen to, after a while, I think he got a little bit burnt out in the business and had chosen to not spend as much time there. I wish I could say that it was systems that he put in place to allow for that. But what did allow for that was his real estate. And so I grew up watching him be very present with me and spend a lot of time, coached my baseball teams, football teams, everything growing up. And so that was kind of the model and what I knew going into the business many years later.
So in many respects, as a very young version of you, you literally grew up at the family business a little bit.
Yeah, I did. So
a lot of people, and I was actually in that camp coming out of college. A dear friend of mine reminds me that I said, I don't know exactly what I'll do next, but I'll be damned if I go to work for my old man and find myself turning down a job opportunity a month later to go into the family business.
Work with your old man.
Yeah. But a lot of people do maybe have that sentiment like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do what my parents did. Ian, for you, what pulled you in? What pulled you in and what kept you in?
There were a couple things that moved the needle. When I got out of college, this is 2009, it was not a good time to find a job. At school, I went to the University of Texas. I was an economics major. So you have a grasp. I wouldn't say you're specialized in anything when you're an economics major. I had tried to work this internship at Merrill Lynch and hated it. It was number one, it was a free to them, zero money to me internship. And I was cold calling. And then I thought, what's it going to be like when I go to the next step and try to find a job? I thought I was going to do consulting or work for this large firm. Then my dad had approached me and it was a very short conversation. He said, I know what you're going to do. What's that? I want you to go work at the dry cleaners. Run it like it's yours. It's not yours, but I want you to run it that way. And I remember it never had been in the cards for me as a fallback. I honestly didn't think I'd end up there. Because I knew in every business, you don't hear about the good often. It's always the bad. The bad just hovers over the memory. And after a while, I thought, you know, let me try this. And I went in, I didn't really have a clear position. And I just hit the ground running. I worked every position from the ground up, pressing clothing, taking stains out of clothes. 14 years later, I still did the same, just not every day, but I could. And that was the important thing. If I had to get in there and show the team, this is how we do it, I could. And that was always in my back card when they said, we can't do it. But yeah, I fell in love with it. There was something about being able to make a decision and that then turning into some sort of impact or change that was either gradual or immediate. And the success of the choices that you made and what came from those, when you know that it falls on your shoulders, it's indescribable versus I don't think you can get that from a company standpoint. I helped so and so's company scale to X. It's a great accomplishment on your resume, but I don't feel that it satisfies people in the way that being a business owner can. And so I just fell in love with that whole world of small business and entrepreneurship.
And that's very, very true. Even thinking about the clients we serve, those that are smaller or mid-sized, we make an impact. You could see the impact where the larger global providers, it's like we maybe made a little tiny ripple.
Yeah.
In the water, like, is that little ripple? Yeah, we made that little ripple happen. And it's just like, yeah, you made an impact, but you don't really feel it, you don't see it, and it's almost like just marginally happened.
I spoke to someone the other day, very key player in a very large company, but everybody knows his name and he's getting ready to retire. And he said, it'll be a distant memory in 5 months when I'm hanging out of my house and the next person has taken over, as if I'm forgotten. And obviously, that can happen in anything in life. But to your point, these really large organizations, I hate using the term, the phrase, you're just a number, because I don't believe it. I think that you still develop relationships. You
Sure.
meet probably many of your very good friends at your in your workplace because people spend a lot of time there. But to your point, it's just something a little bit different when it's yours. And so I'm very
Oh, yeah.
pro business ownership. Shout from the rooftops for people to get involved. And I think a lot more people now are doing that very thing as we're seeing mass layoffs and instability with careers that otherwise used to be very safe. I think
Yeah.
people are now questioning which direction they want to go.
Yeah, we're definitely in a season of change. And I think we're going to stay there for some time. Obviously, there's mixed feelings about that, and with AI playing a heavy role in that change. But with change and challenge, I think also comes tremendous opportunity if you
Yes.
are wise to it, open to it, and attentive to it. Bringing it back though, too, because I know we talked a little before this interview, we were talking about when you came into the business, Ian, it was struggling, right? It was not killing it. I think it was a bit of a rough patch for the business. Talk about that from coming into a business that was struggling a bit and what you did in those first few years to start to turn the ship around.
Yes, it was struggling, and I'll start with this. I didn't have business experience, didn't know how to run a company, didn't know how to lead. These are things that you either have in you or learn along the way. And so I was ready for the ride. And when I got in, there were so many things that, from a struggling standpoint, first of all, there were times where we weren't covering payroll with sales and expenses. So I remember my dad was having to pull out from his real estate investments to cover payroll. And then maybe he'd pay himself back later. But these are the things that I had seen over the years. And I thought, I don't ever want that to be the case. So I just got to work on the fundamentals. In any business, regardless of your industry, it's built on small, repeatable actions, working hard, doing the hard things when nobody else wants to. In our business specifically, it was little stuff. The dry cleaning industry is typically 10, 15 years behind what the industry or others may be. And when I say that, for example, we were very limited to what systems were out there for point of sale. Nowadays, there's incredible systems that are out there that can work in a variety of industries. In the dry cleaning space, we're starting to see a little bit more them and laundromats starting to merge worlds. But we did not have a point of sale system. And this was 2009, 2010, no point of sale. Everything was paper. It was very messy. We had
Right.
no company uniforms. So imagine all these stores. And I remember going into these shops, and the gals would have shirts that were too revealing, tattoos on the arms with curse words and piercings in their face. And a lot of those people, I think that would have been happy to put a uniform on, but that direction wasn't there. So I think there was a lot of low-hanging fruit that I could clean up first. We also were a low price, or they call them discount cleaners, but essentially it's a lower price, good value, high value operate. With that comes very small margins. And so we needed volume. When we took on that approach for years, the answer was our prices are low, the quality is not that good, or the service isn't good. So what? Because they're paying a really cheap price. And so I tried to turn that upside down, because if you get online, it doesn't matter if a consumer is paying $10 or $50 for something, they want it to be of expectation or higher. For all the small business owners out there, y'all know this. There are a lot of happy customers. Let's say 95% of your customers, or 99, are happy, and then the 1% is upset. Those are the ones that are loud. And so if you got online and looked at the dry cleaners, we had all these locations and they're like 2 stars on Google, 1 star on Yelp. Yelp's a different story. And you guys have all probably been threatened by somebody on Yelp. It was always entertaining.
Oh,
But
yeah.
it was something that business owners have to navigate. So just along the way, putting in systems to allow us to encourage reviews because things do go wrong. And when that does go wrong, that 1 star review is not going to stand out in a sea of 200 5 star reviews. This is very common in business now, specifically service business. But along the way, all those little things, just focusing on service, focusing on the people, and then showing them that they care because the team could go get another job somewhere else and make more money and maybe not have to get griped at as much by customers. So my job was I was a glorified babysitter of having to make sure that we had a good company culture, that they knew that I was there to support them, that I would work with them. I'd clean toilets when we had to clean toilets. Just that whole lead by example mentality so that they knew there's no excuse to fail at what we're doing here. And those that
Awesome.
did want to fail, they got rid of themselves. They just
Yeah.
walked away when they knew this is what the expectations are.
That's great. That's amazing. Yeah. I think I was in a similar boat when I joined and decided to make the decision to come into the family business. The first time I was looking at a P&L, I never looked at one before in my life. I was 22
Yeah.
and I'm looking at it and I said, Dad, why is this last number in the August column negative? It's in parentheses. He goes, we lost money in August. I said, why is this bigger number over here next to it? Also in parentheses, we've been losing money all year. And I'm like thinking, what did you get me into? And, much like yourself, it's starting to say, where can I make an impact? Where can I fix that? And starting to tinker in my own way, like you did, to start to say, this obviously won't do. But I wonder if it's generationally, because I remember my dad, things were bad. He would just push money back into the business. It was kind of like a pendulum. When the business needed money, he would push money back in, then he would take it out, sometimes not take a salary, all those things, a little more fluid and much like you. And I'm like, I don't think I want to run my life that way.
Yeah, you got to set stuff up to where you don't run into that position. And also, number one, you probably came in, a lot of small business is based on emotion from the owner, how much they're going to put back into their business. I'm not talking financially, but their efforts.
Sure.
And you probably saved your dad. And I feel that I know my dad was happy when I came in because when I bought the business a few years later, he was finally making money again on the acquisition side or from him selling.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to talk to you about that too. So you bought the business from your dad in, I think it was 2016, right, Ian?
2016, yeah.
Okay. So if you could just talk for a moment, what was that process like? So how did it come up and how did you work through that process of financial transition and business ownership transition?
This one was a lot easier than when I exited, but I'll talk about getting into it. So it was a familiar transaction. Number one, he needed to be paid for it. The IRS doesn't like families to just give the business to the next person, nor would we want that, right? Like he built this
Right.
company that had strong roots in Austin. People, it's still thriving. People know the name. They're winning awards. So for me, it was okay, let's set this up to where, number one, I didn't have a lump sum of money to put down a down payment. So I got a sweet deal because although I was 7 figures in debt, it was a seller finance, zero down seller finance situation. Also, a very low interest rate. So business buyers today don't have that same luxury. Rates aren't too friendly, and neither are the sellers. It worked out really smoothly from a operational standpoint, zero change. When I got involved, my dad wasn't going to work, and so we actually didn't work a day together. That's how emotionally detached he was. He was
Wow.
still the owner,
Okay.
but from the decision-making standpoint, yeah, there were a couple things where I'd reach out and say, "Hey, I got to pay this. How do you want to handle it?" 'Cause it was his ultimate decision, but that was very rare. And when the transaction took place, it was January 1st of 2016, everything was already penciled and done in 2015 at the end, but it was just this is the date that it'll take effect. Zero operational change because I already been running it for that was 6 years at that point. But we had that conversation. You either need to sell or I need to go because that's in. So it was beneficial for both of us to have that conversation. And it wasn't a struggle for him. He was like, great, when do my monthly payments start? And they started in January 2016.
That's eerily familiar because I had the very same conversation with my father. Something along the lines of, I think it was in towards the end of 1999. It was basically, Dad, I love you, but one of us needs to go somewhere else
Yeah.
to do their thing. I.e., he was in that state of like semi-retired, but not fully. And I had already been a couple of years then at that point into the buyout. And I was still willing to walk away. I'm like, listen, if you want to do this, you do it. You ride it off in the sunset. I'm cool. I'll go do something else. But if you want me to do it, I need you now to step down.
Yeah, and
And
family business is hard, especially having those conversations, but it's good that you guys were able to see through it. I joke with him. I said, I would have fired you anyway if you were still around. So just go in good standing. No, he knows it. He'll tease people. Him and I are best friends. And so we laugh about that, but we're very different. He's the fun-spirited, laughing all the time and happy guy joking around. Whereas I, when it came to business, I was very serious. I was a penny pincher. I'm very frugal. And I watch the expenses to the extreme. Because that's one thing, by the way, in business ownership, I always tell people, you can't control the revenue that, you know, yes, your efforts can get you to a point of revenue, but you ultimately don't control that final number, but you can control expenses. And so that's one thing that over the years that helped that company be more profitable was we would have, again, I mentioned earlier, we worked in volume. So let's pretend that there were 5,000 pieces being cleaned each day. That's 5,000 hangers and some clips and all sorts of things that we would use. And it would get to the point to where if I could save a penny on a hanger or a product, that could amount to $10,000, $20,000, depending on what product that was. So if you do that a couple of times and you're saving pennies on these products, that's the kind of volume and the kind of decision making that makes it so much fun. But yeah, a penny would save that much. And so then if you're valuing your business, I'll use easy math. Let's pretend that penny saved you $10,000. And that brought 10,000 to the bottom line. If you're selling your company at a 3x multiple, that's 30,000 bucks from a penny. So think of the ROI on that penny. As I always tell people, hey, run your business like you're going to sell it. Think about things in these terms because it's helpful and it'll help you be a better owner and operator.
Wow, that's a great perspective and probably a way to think of it that most people don't even. So thank you for sharing that. If you were to, given your experience of your transition, let's say some of our listeners are sitting in that either second or third or maybe even fourth generation seat, what advice would you give that next generation about balancing respect for the previous generation, but the need to make that transition, to lead, to take ownership, and ultimately make that business their own?
I think it starts with your character and your ability to lead. So, statistically speaking, second generation owners are failures as a whole. Ed, you're still here, so beat the odds. But
And you did too, my friend, as
yeah.
did you.
But generally speaking, they fail. And that's because the founder has a lot more pride and emotion into it. Kids maybe are entitled and they get in there and they think, you know, that it's going to be easy. And entrepreneurship's not. It doesn't matter what you do. And so for that next generation, I would say there's a big push today about implementing systems and working on your business and not in it. I would say in the very beginning, if you want a successful business, you need to work in that business. You should know to what you can in your capacity as much as you possibly can in that role, from the lowest job to the, obviously you're the highest. Where I see people fail, and not necessarily just second generation businesses with a family dynamic shift, but sometimes even a new owner that's third party, they'll come in and they'll want to change. And people are resistant to change. Sometimes it's welcomed, but I would say for anybody, get in, keep it running so you can familiarize yourself with what this process looks like, and then incrementally make changes that benefit the people, your process, your product, whatever you're seeking to enhance.
Yeah. And from my observations, it would seem that those that are of the next generation that make the transition and ultimately either maintain, sustain, or ultimately grow the business typically started like you and I did, where they're coming in at the lowest level, not the highest level, the lowest level. They're in the trenches, they're working shoulder to shoulder. I remember someone, they were an account executive, came in and saw that I had finished something. And she's like, "When did you get this done?" I said, "Yesterday," and it was Monday. So yeah, I came in on Sunday and I did this work because I knew it had to be done today. So that realization too, that you're not just here because you're your father's son, you're here to work and you're willing to put in the time to make it work. When once they start to see that, I think that they start to turn that attitude like, oh, he's not just here for a handout, he's here to work. And
You'll laugh at this. I lease a space, a commercial space to a restaurant, new restaurant venture, amazing food. But in the beginning, the owner would come in, young guy, came from a family, and he's a great guy. But the mindset is difficult to overcome because when they think, if you come from a position of being an employee somewhere or a W-2, you think a lot differently. You went in on a Sunday and didn't think about it. You're not clocking in, you're just that you have to get it done. And I remember hearing this guy say, I work 10 hours today, or I've already made my hours this week. And I'm like, what do you, what is that? You, there's no such thing as, I forget who said the line about like how many hours you work in a day. And the answer was all of them. And yeah, I think in entrepreneurship, we celebrate busy. Now people are seeing the light and they're like, no, we want to celebrate not being busy. But for many of us, myself included, I thought being busy was better until I learned, well, there's a better way. The new owner is doing that, right? He's not as busy as I was, and things are still improving. So clearly, there's opportunity to not have to be the center of the operation. But yeah,
That's
to your question of advice, yeah, that's it. Work in the business, have good character, be a good leader, because if your team doesn't like you, you're going to have a hard time keeping that staff. They can go somewhere else.
for sure, for sure. So let's go forward a bit. So after, successfully navigating the buy from your father, 15 years of running the business, growing the business, in around, I think it was like 2023, you decided it was time to move on. Take us over to that point, Ian. What was going on then, and why did you feel it was time to exit?
It was an emotional struggle. The business survived COVID, very difficult on the dry cleaning industry and many industries. On the flip side, some did amazingly well. But during that time, I had to lay off a lot of employees, but had to figure out how can I keep this business running? I still have a lot of leases, I still have wages, but there's no income coming in. And so that was a tricky time to navigate. A lot of things like savings and reserves and things that I had put into place prior had helped me get through that. But I think when we turned the corner on what COVID did for that industry specifically, I was starting to have children. So my daughter was born in 2020, and then I had a son born in 23. And at this point, I was pretty emotionally checked out because I would go home and my wife would say something and I'd say, or just not thinking. That's that whole thing, like you can hear, but your ears hear it, but you're not listening to
Not
anything.
listening,
And then I would just look at my kids and I just felt like I wasn't present. And so I had reached a point, a lot of people were like, and my dad included, hey, you're too young. Why would you sell this now? The business was, by that time in 23, I was making great money. The business had really healthy profits. Things were good. And I wasn't going to replace that income the next year or for several years. And so what I thought was, okay, what do I want to do? And clearly the answer, it wasn't about money. It was about how can I put myself in a position to where, number one, I think I'm doing a disservice to the employees and team that if my head's not mentally there. So it was that whole switch had just gone off, and a series of events led to a guy. I got an email one day, and it was a lucky email. I answered the email, and literally, I had, I don't know, 18,000 unread emails, and I had got this unknown one about buying. But got me. He said, I want to buy your, and he listed the specific entity, and I had several entities, and I'm thinking, how the hell did that guy know that entity? Yeah, we just started having conversations. And then after probably a year of discussions, we came to a close. And that was it. And I couldn't have asked for a better person to pass that company on to. He retained 100% of key employees, which is amazing. There was a legacy component to this, right? It was my dad's. I put my heart and sweat into this thing, and I didn't want it. This wasn't a money transaction. Like I wanted it to be in good standing and live for the next 50 years. And that's where it's going strong. He's 2 years in.
Nice. Did your dad have any feelings about it either way? Like when you said, okay, dad, I'm selling, did he? Or was he pretty much exited? Not really. The ship is yours, Ian. You do what with it what you will. What was the sentiment like there?
I think he wasn't trying to sway me in either direction, but what I think he posed the question of, are you sure you're ready to do this? Where else can you go? And because again, I mentioned that 22, 23 became successful years. And honestly, had it not been for along the way, I got involved in the real estate space, started buying, this is 2014, started buying rentals in Austin. Austin was cheaper. Now it's once again the best place in the country. It was just named to be a real estate buyer. Because for residential, because there's so many homes in the market and market's slow. But anyway, reverse to 2014, I started buying a rental property, and then I buy one the next year in 15. I did it in 16, and then I got some commercial properties. So I was using all of my proceeds from the dry cleaners to go buy rentals. And there was always this conversation, if I get to a point to where my rental income matches what I make in the business, then it makes it that much easier to walk away, growing wealth outside of your business. So when I sold the business, my income stopped and the distributions and how I was paying myself all stopped. But I still had income coming in from the rental properties, which made it to where it wasn't this rush to say, what the hell am I going to do now? And so that was why when I talked to my dad about this, and again, he mentioned, you're so young. Are you sure you want to do this? But the answer was yes. Ultimately, he supported that decision. He was like, we were just wrapping up his 9-year note, and he was made whole. I was made whole, and then left some meat on the bone for the next guy. And now it gave me the energy to pick this. I talked about children in the season of life. My kids are very young, and I wanted to be that dad that has the ability to take my kids to practice if I want to, when I want to. And so that's what working really hard and then building up things outside of my business allowed me to do.
So Run Steady Investments, your current company, really was the origins, you might say, are really born in that maybe that 2014, 2015 when you started investing in real estate yourself. Was that kind of where the seed was planted, or was it something a bit of a different catalyst?
The seed was there and it started from that. I knew that I loved that space because I understood it. As an entrepreneur, you're used to looking at P&Ls, and there were so many investments that are out there that I just didn't understand. I wanted to figure out a way, where do I put the money from the sale? Venture capital, I looked at all these things and so I didn't understand it. How are you going to sell me on 20 companies will fail and one will make it big? Trust us, or you'll lose it all, or you'll hit big. And I was like, I wasn't in a position to gamble. I'm generally a low risk guy. I still invest that way. I'm not finding these massive opportunities that are the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's if I can hit a single over and over, there's a repeatable long-term path to progress there, path to having some more wealth. So I needed, after I sold a, I was looking for ways to mitigate the tax burden that was going to come up. And because of how my wife and I had our status with the IRS, she was a real estate professional. We had rentals already. We had Airbnbs and short-term rentals, and she wasn't working in any other capacity besides that. And being a mother, hardest job in the world, but real estate was the answer. So there's massive depreciation benefits that you can take advantage of when you're investing in real estate. And for us, that was, hey, why, if I can put money into something, and by the way, when I say put money into something, I wasn't going out and trying to acquire new properties myself. I didn't have that much time. So this is the first time I was introduced to the world of passive investing in this whole syndication world. So syndication, basically, for everyone listening, is people pooling money together to go buy property. And there's one person who's active that's doing that. And then everybody else putting their money in is passive. So it's this whole idea of owning real estate without messing with the day to day. I was doing this for myself personally for 6 months and I was bored out of my mind. I was vetting deals, underwriting. And then I thought, I need to come up with a business to maybe I don't have employees. And that's why I decided to go all in on this because I don't have to have staff now. I have remote staff, but it's not like the old days where somebody would call in sick 10 minutes before their shift starts. And
That's
I got
right.
to drive to open a store on the other side of town. The whole thing was, I like real estate. People should know that they can invest passively in it, that it's not all smoke and mirrors like Instagram tells you, because there's a lot of crap online about how you can make money and yada. And I would just say, be very, if you lead from a position of being risk adverse, don't be swayed as you're, if you're looking to grow wealth outside your business by these ads that promise you're going to make double your money by the end of the year. I'm sure it exists, but like it wasn't my thing. So that's what I do now. I help business owners that have the money but don't have the time passively invest into private lending funds and mobile home parks so they can either get income that's fixed or they can build equity and have the depreciation, like whatever better suits their particular position. I'm having fun with it, building up the network. We send out deals to people, and now, you know, we're all co-investing as a group together.
That's awesome. So many business owners, especially those that might be second or third gen, who tend to be sometimes they're more aggressive, sometimes they're more conservative. Again, don't want to sink the ship if they're a next generation. They struggle maybe to think about wealth beyond the company. So a lot of times it's a very tunnel vision view, if you will. My wealth is what I can generate from the business and not more. How do you help them start to awaken that vision, Ian, that there is a bigger wealth strategy through real estate? And no, it's not a distraction that some people might perceive it to be.
I think business owners have a unique ability to compare to a W-2 employee to make a lot of money from their business. And so I'll say, if you can reinvest in your business and that's what you know well and that's what you do very well, you should do it. However, you need to allocate something to go outside of that. I'm sure there's gurus out there or very successful people that say, no, you can only invest in yourself. But then you have these other people that will preach the mindset of partnership and the whole what if factor. So in life, they use this in a lot of industries, but it's the 5 Ds. It's the death, disability, divorce, forgetting the other ones. But the point is, things come up in life that can pull you away from your business. So if you are the head of the ship and all of a sudden you get into a car accident and you break your back or you can't come to work for 3 months, what will that do and how can that impact your business and your wallet? And so I tell people, success, if you're successful, great, keep it going, get that cash flow, but you should be looking for other ways to park funds. Even if the biggest thing I've seen with business owners is having a really healthy or too healthy cash reserves in their checking account. I talked to somebody the other day. It was like $300,000 in their business checking account. And I was like, that's amazing. Good job. Do you need $300,000 sitting in your checking? No, it's just I've done well and that's where it stays. And the next question is, okay, how much do you need for an emergency? What happened when payroll and rent hit at the same time? And then let's on the other side balance in your receivables or how you're paid. What would go out of your account on any given day that's a max? And if they have $300,000 and they're like, okay, payroll and rent, maybe 70K would be the biggest expense if I really had to push stuff out. It's okay. So you're sitting on too much. The bank is earning money on the few $100,000 that's sitting in your account. It's your money, but they're taking it out of your, that's just a digital dashboard, right? They're lending your money to somebody else. Why don't you do the same? So it's these conversations I like having with business owners to get them thinking outside the box of opportunity cost. What can you do with your money while it's sitting there? How can you give it a job? Because if it's not, you're falling behind. If you know you can't beat inflation, you're at a negative whatever 3% on your earnings if it's sitting in your checking account earning zero. So just, I don't know. I wish somebody would have come to me 10 years ago and said, hey, you look like a busy guy, but business is doing okay. Do you want to partner up and I can run XYZ for you? And so that's what I help introduce to people in a safe manner. And I like business owners because that's my passion is entrepreneurship and real estate. And this business is the overlap of the two of those.
Nice. And a lot of great points and a lot of great takeaways there. Speaking of, let's talk about Run Steady Investments for a minute. Built around mobile home parks and private lending, not exactly the flashiest of the flashy side of the real estate spectrum, if you will. Why do you believe in what you've referred to in passly as boring investments?
I told you I was a low risk guy. So that this plays into the whole persona of the business. I believe in this stuff because I've done it. So I'm still at what they call like there's a differentiation between what's an active investor and a passive investor in real estate. Active means you own it, you manage it, you're dealing with the tenants. That's active. That was me. And I still am. I just don't pursue it to the same degree I used to because it's time intensive, capital intensive. Mobile home parks and private lending, I got into these on my own before the business had begun, and they were the best of both worlds. One of them doesn't have the tax benefits, but it has the cash flow. This is the private lending stuff. And it's, oh, I can earn 8, 9, or 10% every year on my money where it was parked in a money market account. This is October of 2023 when money market accounts are at 5.5%. Now they're at 3.5. You can crawl up to 4. So for me, looking at that, I'm like, if I could double my return, but still have a very safe, low risk vehicle to park it in, let's do that. So that's the private lending component. It was me putting my own money into it. I do that in all my deals, by the way. I'm the first investor. So there's a big alignment with we all have the same interest at heart. I am not that person opening a playbook of options to get commission on people that come into these deals. It's, hey, I just put $100,000 into it. And so did these other team. We're doing it as a group. I'm not selling something I don't believe in. And so that's the big difference now. And in the whole thesis of this business is I'll put my money where my mouth is. I support this. And I'm also like, for me, I'd rather preserve my money and make zero, then lose money. And so when I talked about risk earlier, there's a lot of stuff out there. It's you're going to make 15, 18, 20%. And if they can be legitimate and you may make that money, but there's a risk and you have to weigh what risk component you're at. So mobile home parks are that industry that's, they solve the affordable housing crisis. They're under the radar for what people traditionally would think to invest in because you might think trailer parks, I don't want to. That sounds junky or like a slum lord. And it's like, I can promise you there are, number one, they're beautiful mobile home parks around the US. Even if you haven't seen them, they exist. Go to Florida. There's some in California. Probably every state has them, retirement communities. But mainly they solve the affordable housing crisis and the supply is somewhat restricted. You can't just go build another one like you can an apartment complex. So it's the combination of what do I think people will need long term? Affordable housing is obviously one of those. And what is a non-flashy, quote unquote, boring investment that I feel comfortable with? And those are the two lanes that I stick in and help people with now. So I turn a lot of people away, by the way, that are like, I don't like that, or I want a higher return. I'm like, great. I want you to have that higher return too. Your risk tolerance is obviously higher than mine. Go get it. Good luck. And I want them to succeed in that, but it's not what I'm looking for.
And you're right. I mean, your approach and your philosophy and your focus is very pragmatic. And there's a lot out there on the internet about get rich quick and real estate's the way and all of that. And It always sounds great. The reality is probably not so much of what the hype is all about. Your approach is very refreshing in that regard, and the approach where you tend to lead first before bringing others in. I think you spoke to that at your core of your philosophy. So I'm going to put my money in because I believe in this, and then putting your money where your mouth is every step of the way.
And that from a risk perspective, like I'm background checking these people, I'm flying to the sites, we're walking through everything. It's so much of what I see now. And even I get pitched as an investor, everything's just like an information pamphlet. You could have got on PowerPoint or Canva and created what you think you're going to get. But then the main value for someone like me is if you have someone that's not necessarily a real estate person, but they want to invest and they want to get involved. They may not know how to look at the underwriting. That's my job, is to poke holes in what the person running the actual day-to-day has created and to see, is this viable? Does this make sense? And I'm looking at it through the lens of what I did with running a 10 to 15% margin business and my P&Ls, because real estate's the same thing. It's a business. It's run with people. There's a need, you're supplying a need, and there's a P&L. And so it is no different, and it's not as complicated as one would think to get involved into it, to understand, okay, how's this thing make money? What are
Right.
its risks, et cetera.
Interesting. As you talk about it, yeah, it's very much like assessing how a business would assess another business. They look at all the same variables. They just might be a little different than what they're accustomed to, but all the same fundamentals, if you will, are at play. How does it make money? What are the risks? What's the downside? What's the upside? What are the strengths, weaknesses, the SWOT analysis, all of that good stuff comes into play. And then you decide based on, again, to your point, risk tolerance. Do you have a high risk tolerance? Do you have a low risk tolerance? Where are you sitting? As well as a greater, a more expansive opportunity than, say, doing transactions with the banks themselves. Because my experience has always been banks want to lend you all kinds of money when you don't need it. But the second you need it, they're like, who are you again? What?
Yeah, there's also with banks for the prod. I'll name a project we did recently. It was 150 units. This is a mobile home park. By the way, mobile home park is now called manufactured housing communities, but I still
Okay.
call it mobile home park. When we go to raise these projects, you want to raise about half the money. For example, say you have a $5 million property, you want to raise about 2.5 million and have more raised, and they call that equity that's coming to the table. That's people's money, that's investors and so forth, than what the bank has. It helps you negotiate better terms. It allows you to survive the debt payment that you have to, that's due every month. And you're now working with partners on it because in all honesty, it's cheaper to go and pay the bank because investors demand a return. From a partnership standpoint, if things go south, there's a lot more flexibility with 50 people that have their private money in there, to where you can pause distributions, you can slow down to reorganize things, versus the bank would just say, we're foreclosing on you, the
Yeah.
time's up. So fortunately, I'm not like looking to get into those investments. Those are big turnaround projects. But yeah, that's how it works. You talk about the banks, and that's why people play a crucial role, because the person running the day-to-day, they need the funds to be able to close these properties. So it's unlike other investments, it's positioned to where the investor comes first. They get paid their return. If they don't get paid it through cash flow, like on a particular property, you're still owed that chunk. That's called preferred return. We tell you a number. If cash flow doesn't get you there, it's not, hey, sorry, this year we gained 5% and we told you 7 or 8. It's okay, here's your 5% from cash flow, and then we still owe you the 3% delta when, as we're improving this property. So it's fun. I think it's aligned to where the investor gets the benefit of the deal. And plus, we're paying for someone else to run it. That's why we're getting in passively. Real
I like
estate's a
that
full-time
model.
job. It's hard. You have to dedicate a lot of time like a business,
Oh,
and
yeah.
you want to put that in the hands of teams that are already doing that and not yourself. I'm not asking people, hey, pitch in a bunch of money and I'll go buy a property and I'm going to run it myself. No, I'm looking for established teams where we leverage their experience to run the day-to-day so we don't have to.
Nice. Nice. Gosh, you're a wealth of knowledge on this subject, Ian. We could probably talk all day.
Yeah,
And
sorry. I get excited about it and just ramble on, but yeah, I love it.
all good stuff, though. Last question for you. If somebody wanted to connect with you and learn more about what you're doing with Run Steady Investments, what's the best way to connect with you?
I'll share a link in the show notes, and basically it's a cheat sheet that I have created This cheat sheet's going to tell people what passive investing in real estate is, what questions they should be asking, what it looks like if you sign up for one of these deals step by step. So it's a really good informational guide if you're curious about what it's like. And I'll say it's also good for people that already own their own real estate. You're going to learn something new as well. So that'll be there. And then you'll have website link, LinkedIn. But that cheat sheet is the key ingredient to really help people that are curious to learn more about what I do.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that resource with us and with our listeners. This has been a great conversation, man. Your story really, it truly captures so much about what this show is about. It's about building a family legacy, evolving it, and now in your capacity with Run Steady, helping others do the same. So again, we've been speaking with Ian Noble of Run Steady Investments, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll see you next time. Ian, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning in to Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.